Welcome to the Doug and Birch Legal Visionaries Podcast, brought to you by Interactive Legal. Here's your host, Mary Vandenack.
Welcome to today's episode of Legal Visionaries, a weekly podcast discussing updated legal news, as well as evolving methods of providing legal service. I'm Mary Vandenack. I will be your host as we talk to experts from around the country about legal and tax issues, trust and estate, business succession and exit planning, law practice technology, management, leadership, and occasionally well-being. First of all, I want to thank our sponsors, Interactive Legal, Foster Group, Veterans Victory Housing and Business Centers, and Carson Private Client. Here's a message from Interactive Legal.
Technology has become an essential part of our daily lives. However, not all fields have embraced technology. Lawyers, especially estate planning attorneys, need to stay up to date with specific laws and any issues affecting taxes and wealth preservation. Implementing an automated drafting system can help lawyers spend more time with their clients and less time doing back office tasks. Estate planners and law professionals turn to Interactive Legal as their main resource for the latest planning strategies. Interactive Legal provides the most comprehensive productivity system on the market, with an easy-to-use document drafting system, extensive continuing education, thought-provoking discussion forums, and more. With Interactive Legal, attorneys get to spend more time with their clients. It's time to connect, collaborate, and create. To learn more about Interactive Legal, visit interactivelegal.com.
Wealth planning focuses on liquidity management and charges you a fee based on a percentage of your assets. But entrepreneurs typically invest in their business, resulting in light liquidity. That requires a unique strategy. At Carson Private Client, we provide a proactive and holistic strategy for building and protecting your wealth. Our mission is to alleviate the stresses and the burdens of coordinating all of those financial strategies. Carson Private Client will work with your current team of advisors to customize a strategy that manages all aspects of your life and wealth, giving you back the time to focus on what matters most. Complex needs require sophisticated solutions. Reach out to our office at 402-779-8989 to schedule your consultation. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
On today's episode, I'm going to switch roles and have Sherry Duryea of Duryea Marketing interview me. She's going to ask me some questions that she and I are both passionate about, senior living communities. I asked her to help me with this because we both have moms of an age where I've just moved my mother into a senior community and Sherry's working on it.
That's right.
And we've both dealt with a lot of the issues related to aging and what we have to look at when we look at those communities. Thanks for helping me out today, Sherry.
Well, thanks for asking me, Mary. Like you said, this is a topic that I am knee-deep in, so this will be fun. Senior living communities are becoming increasingly popular in our generation. And can you tell me some of the main differences between the living communities and nursing homes?
And I will, because a lot of people still think of a senior community or moving into housing as what is called skilled nursing care. So you go there and you're just going to die in 10 days. And that's not what it is today. And there's actually some data. And I know I mentioned that my mom, and she's a great example. We went through the pandemic and she was much more limited at getting out. She finally agreed to move into a facility, which she can actually see my office from. And so I could tell she was getting more acclimated to living there when she stopped calling me 8 times a day. So
sure.
She'd look out her window, see my office, and she would call me. Well, can you come over? I'm at work, Mom, you know. And anyway, so she's getting, but there's a lot of evidence and data that says having that social access is really helpful to those. I heard a story from a client today about his mom moving in, and she'd gone off all her medications and was ready to die. She moved in. She's doing really well, enjoying herself. So the independent living facilities are actually communities. I mean, there's private apartments that are just here senior apartments, but I'm really talking about a community that's designed for seniors and they're still able to live independently so they can take care of their own daily activities of living. And these communities a lot of times are great just because they offer some services such as meals. There's the ability to go to your own apartment and not be around people if you want the quiet, but you can also have housekeeping. There are social activities and often transportation. What these independent living facilities do not provide is assistance with medical needs or personal care. So if you're living in that type of facility, you have to realize this is an independent living facility. My mom has run into that a couple times. She's in independent living. And you know, she ran her leg into a dishwasher or something like that and was upset because there was nobody. I'm like, Mom, you're in independent living.
Right.
So that's why they don't provide medical care. We'll figure that out. They will drive her to an appointment, but not provide the care. The next type of senior community is what's called an assisted living facility. So this is a facility that provides a higher level of care. To qualify to live in one, you have to have issues with at least some daily living activities, and this type of facility will help. So as a result of that, there are more extensive regulatory requirements. So we have licensing requirements. There are ratios of staff to residents, specific training standards related to the facilities, a lot of health and safety regulations, and resident care standards. So, of course, with all that, it's a little more expensive as well. The regulations, though, are designed to ensure the safety and well-being of residents. There are also memory care facilities. So we hear about Alzheimer's and dementia. Typically, what the assisted living facilities, and the rules on these are different in every state. So I'm not going to give a 50-state list. I'm going to speak very generally today about the types of facilities. But most commonly, what happens with a memory care facility is it's an endorsement to an assisted living facility. So we have an assisted living facility that's licensed for that purpose, and they also then decide to provide memory care. It's typically a separate unit, a little bit different type of services to help those who have developed some of those issues with dementia or Alzheimer's. And the last I mentioned at the start is the skilled nursing facilities. So those are intended for those seniors who require significant medical care and daily assistance. They are equipped with licensed and medical professionals and offer services such as 24-hour supervision. There's healthcare and there's assistance with everyday tasks. So I recently had a client in a skilled nursing facility who couldn't get from bed to the bathroom anymore. So she needed that type of help. I am going to focus mostly as we talk today on the independent facilities and assisted living facilities. The skilled nursing is a very specific and different that would require a separate episode. So I can't quite speak to you generally so much as the others.
So what rules typically apply to independent living facilities?
So you have to keep in mind, again, what I mentioned. That
independent.
Yep, exactly, Sherry. It's independent. So it's really similar to just renting an apartment. So, you know, the example of my mom thinking that all this stuff should be taken care of for, and a reminder, well, Mom, you're in independent living and she's actually not ready to go to assisted living. She doesn't qualify. She's a pretty healthy 91-year-old who still drives and cooks and all those type of things. But, you know, as we have with any residential facility, we're going to have local housing codes, state housing codes, federal regulations. There are some specific state rules that will apply to senior communities, but at the independent living facility, they are not going to be the same as at the assisted living. Independent living facilities, again, typically don't provide the medical care, so we don't have all of those medical rules and regulations applying.
So what rules apply to assisted living facilities?
So most states do require that an assisted living facility get a specific license and qualify as an assisted living facility. And so you may have the state come in and do investigations to review to make sure you're complying with the various rules. Staffing ratios. So we're providing medical services. So we want to make sure a resident isn't sitting in their room unattended to with a serious medical issue. The training standards are really important in the assisted living facilities. So we have again, the medical care's higher level of need, maybe help with medication organization. So that all needs to be understood. The training protocols need to make sure that everybody on staff understands how things work. Health and safety regulations, and there are the resident care standards. And again, I mentioned the medication management, but assisted living facilities are also often monitoring health conditions and coordinating healthcare services. Some on-site medical services may be offered. There also may be people coming from off-site and coming in, and that's where the supervision comes in. So all of those, there's some rules and regulations that apply to those.
And I know since this is more the area where my mother is, there's a lot of different levels in assisted living of care and what they will do and what they won't do.
And that's a great point. So usually getting in requires issues with two activities of daily living. But as it progresses, it will require a higher level of care. And one of the things that's important when you mention that is actually the leases. So leases will, because you actually enter into a lease or an agreement with respect to the care that's going to be received. And typically, and most states require that those care levels be reviewed regularly and that they're updated. As the level of care increases, the cost goes up. So it's important to actually know what the cost is and to kind of look at what the costs are going to be in the future as that care level increases, because it's very common that the care level will increase. And I'll mention one other thing. It's also very common that you will get preference to get into an assisted living facility if you are in their independent living before. Sadly, the waiting lists to get into assisted living have grown fairly long.
Yeah.
And so if you wait until it is, you know, time that you really need it, it's going to take a while to get in. So you want to get on the waiting list. And a great way to do it is start with the independent living so you hopefully get priority.
That is a great point, Mary, because we have run into that, as you know.
We are going to take a brief break from our episode for a word from one of our sponsors.
If you had a dollar for every financial advisor that just wanted your money, your financial future would already be secure. At Foster Group, our team is different. One whose focus is on you and your dreams. Together, we'll create a strategy that helps you get there, wherever there is for you. Foster Group, your financial life, truly cared for. Connect with us at fostergrp.com.
Foster Group's written disclosure brochure, as set forth in Part 2A of Form ADV, discusses advisory services and fees, is available at www.fostergrp.com.
Okay, let's continue our episode.
Are there specific rights that apply to residents of senior communities?
So in the independent living, there are the rules related to privacy, autonomy, and freedom of choice. So it's independent living. We're going to let people continue to be independent.
Okay.
And that matters. Those rules also apply to assisted living, but because those in assisted living are receiving medical care, we start to get into some of the specific rights related to healthcare decision making, medication management, and access to services. So to the extent you've enrolled in an assisted living facility, you have a right to get assistance with those activities of daily living and be in an environment where you are safe and your health and safety needs are supported.
Okay. We hear a lot today about data security and privacy. How do those rules apply in these communities?
So for both independent living and assisted living facilities, and actually, you know, for any business, data protection rules, regulations are simply important. I think, you know, one of the most recent kind of fraud I've heard about is the QR ishing, which is scanning QR codes and giving away data. So, you know, do these facilities have an obligation to not let people drop off brochures that potentially have fraud, you know, QR codes that are going to compromise their identity? I don't actually know if there's a rule on that, but it'd be definitely a best practice.
It would, yes.
But every state has rules that apply to communities in that state. And, you know, there's both federal, state, and local regulations that this is one of those things to, you know, that we would say is talk to a expert on this type of issue. But using and disclosing your personal information is limited. There should be safe security safeguards. A lot of facilities provide internet access. So there should be robust cybersecurity measures, especially to the extent they're gathering on their system information about their residents. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a right to privacy that applies. So in the independent living, that information might be fairly basic, but there's still protection rules. When you get into the assisted living and others where the medical services are being provided, then of course we have the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which gets referred to as what's called HIPAA. So to the extent of that, there's fairly rigorous rules about protecting what we call protected health information about anybody. But even to the extent there aren't legal mandates, as I said, best practices. It's a competitive industry. There are a lot of seniors, so we see a lot of facilities involving. People like to be in good care. People are going to hear, you know, we had in Las Vegas a few months back, we all heard about data breaches going on out there. That information becomes very public. Best practices is simply to engage in activities and processes that will protect privacy.
So it does certainly sound like you always have to be proactively prepared. Along that same vein, though, can you tell me about what community operators have to contemplate when doing emergency preparedness and disaster planning?
And can you imagine that?
No, I can't. Getting people out of those facilities, and we've seen it on the news, right?
We have seen it. You think about the fires that
right.
we've seen gone wild, hurricanes, various locations in the yep. country. We're in Nebraska as we record this. We have tornadoes, mm-hmm. which with tornadoes a lot of times
flooding.
You don't know they're coming. But, right, flooding's another issue. So it's one of the most crucial aspects for any senior facility. And whether you're a facility owner thinking about this and mm-hmm. thinking about the risks of the particular location or somebody looking at like me putting my mom in, hey, what are you going to do if we have some flooding type of issues mm-hmm. and asking the questions about that? But there's no one size fits all type of preparedness plan for emergencies. So each senior has unique needs. A lot of them have mobility issues. So that's why the emergency preparedness and response plan is so important. The facility has to design that in accordance with its location, what's its particular risks are, and you maybe have to think about a little out of the box on that. Mm-hmm. And then you have to think about the needs of the different types of residents that live in your community. And even in the independent facilities, they may be independent. My mom, love her dearly, she moves pretty slowly these
yes.
days, right?
Yep.
So getting out in a hurry is not going to be something that would be easy for.
Absolutely. What health care regulations do senior living communities need to be aware of?
Well, so I mentioned HIPAA, which is all about keeping protected health information private. Other regulations that apply are the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's about having access. And you would think that's going to be simple and an absolute at every facility. You'd be surprised to find sometimes there's not. But I think most have gotten pretty good about that, but that is important that that applies. Those are, you know, they have these big rules, but then every state has its own set of regulations governing senior living communities. So they focus on staff, medication, the emergency preparedness. So it's really important for the operators to stay up to date. Because the thing about this, just like any, as the laws sort of developed early in my career, there would be some stability in laws. And now I know mm-hmm. whatever the law was 6 months ago, before I rely on it, I got to check to make sure there wasn't a change.
Sure.
Because there's been what I call a rapid development. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration also sets guidelines for senior communities. So those are kind of the key areas that you have to think about.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned like memory care, but sometimes there are residents who struggle with cognitive capacity. They're not necessarily in a memory care facility, but how does that play?
Well, and let's just talk about that. You could be in a memory facility mm-hmm. and you have cognitive issues, but you might not yet be at the level of being legally incapacitated.
Right.
So whether it's independent living, assisted living, or memory care, there's a question about capacity. And when it comes to discussing capacity, there are different standards for different situations. So let's say healthcare decision making. we really try and support that if it's my mom, as long as she's capable of understanding what's going on, even if I'm her attorney in fact, which I am, at the end of the day, it's up to her if she can understand what's going on. It's a fairly low standard. And we have a new act that's hopefully going to get passed in a lot of the states that makes that really clear. And as somebody who's done of what I call a lot of deathbed work, I can tell you that I had somebody who is very ill. I'm the attorney. In fact, they're looking to me. She was perfectly capable of telling exactly what she wanted. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is not incapacity. This is a woman who says, this is what I want. We try and defer that. Legal capacity is a different issue, and there's different standards. So legal for a power of attorney, there's a standard for that. Executing a will is what we call testamentary capacity. What's important to know is that you're likely going to deal with capacity issues when somebody's aging at some point. And even for some of us who are younger, right?
Right.
Sadly. But what's important on this is that we want to have some best practices in place about what's going to happen. Like if I'm, you know, a senior community, and you'll find that they mostly do this, is they want to see, do you have a power of attorney for healthcare in place? Do you have a legal power of attorney? You can actually require that to move in, because otherwise, let's think about the situation. And I've had this in my career. It's a tough one. Let's say we have somebody who becomes legally incapacitated for both the purposes of medical decision-making as well as legal decision-making. And no family members are around and no one's going to step up to act as guardian or conservator. So guardians of the body, conservator is the legal person. What do you do? Mm-hmm. I got a call at one point from a hospital saying, hey, we have somebody who is totally incapacitated and has no ability to sign papers to discharge themselves. So this is why it's so important. I sometimes, as somebody who does estate planning, say we should really call it life planning. Mm-hmm. Because, well, when I'm dead, I'm dead. And what happens when I'm dead matters. But when I'm incapacitated and still living, I probably care more.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you mentioned lack of capacity. It's my understanding that a big issue in these communities arises when residents might accuse employees of stealing their possessions. And I have heard so many stories along this line. Sometimes it's true and sometimes it isn't. So how do you proactively guard against these accusations?
So that's a tough issue. And I have to tell you, having worked on both sides of the equation, I've got really strong feelings on it. So if you're helping a parent or family member move into a facility, there are services out there that will take an inventory and document for you. They'll do videos, the whole nine yards, of everything that is taken with the resident when they move in and what they did with any items. So let's say that grandma gave a ring to her niece, Anna, before she moved in. Then she moves into the facility and she forgets. Mm-hmm. And so she accuses the nurse of stealing it. But we have this documentation provided for by the company that says, hey, look, and so you just pull that out and say, hey, look, Grandma, Anna's got the ring. Do you want to call her and be reassured? That's hugely helpful.
Oh,
that
yes.
Heads things off in a heartbeat. If you are on the senior community side, well, background checks and extensive interviews are really important. Mm-hmm. The last thing you want is to have an employee who does steal or even worse, mistreat somebody who's living in one of the facilities. Policies and procedures should not just be paperwork. They should be living, breathing documents that people receive training on, and they're strictly enforced. Don't accept policy violations. It's kind of got to be a one strike rule.
Mm-hmm. Are there issues related to managing the residents with cognitive impairments or mental health conditions?
And we've talked a lot about the cognitive impairments, so I'm going to focus a little more on the mental health conditions. And I mentioned that there's this new act, so it's the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act. And this has just been passed by the Uniform Law Commission within the last year. So it hasn't been adopted in any state yet, but it's intended to replace our previous, I can't remember, I think it was in the 1990s is the last time we addressed healthcare decisions. And at that time, we hadn't been through a pandemic. Mm-hmm. It was all kind of new. So one of the things about this act is that you can now include in your power of attorney for healthcare. And let's clarify that that's once the act is passed in a particular state and if that state adopts these provisions, because they don't have to, but they include mental health provisions. So you can specify, you know, I never want this particular medication if I'm having episodes, things like that. So there's a little more control. A lot of people with mental health issues have been through a lot, have been on and off medications, in and out of facilities. Others are more minor, but you can put some specific directions under the new act. We have HIPAA. We've talked about that. It's another reason, but one of the things you want to consider is having a power of attorney that specifically provides HIPAA rights to the power of attorney. So imagine you're incapacitated and it's unclear whether your attorney, in fact, actually has HIPAA rights to review your mental, you know, to remove your health records at all, mental health or otherwise. That can be somewhat problematic.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the new law, the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act. Can you speak to advance directives?
So advance directives is kind of a generic term that refers to any of these end-of-life decision-making documents. So the one that you originally heard about was what we could just call a right to die will. It's in that Nebraska, it's called a declaration. It has different names in other states. In the current environment, that's a document that typically says, if I'm in a persistent vegetative state or terminal condition, then I want total relief from pain, even if it shortens my life. I do or do not want artificial nutrition and hydration. I do or do not want extraordinary health support measures. So one of the things under this new act that I mentioned is there are a lot more options, because there's some things that there's no medical agreement on, which is such as brain death currently. And so we have had to find a way to, how do we address that if there's a disagreement on that? You know, with mm-hmm. Alabama, I mentioned another episode where I talked about the Corporate Transparency Act, but recently ruled that embryos are life. And so that's been an interesting discussion in terms of, well, should they have a healthcare directive now that I think about it? Anyway, and they probably need wills too.
Right.
But anyway, so the right to die will, there's a lot of medical disagreement on some of these things and legal disagreement. So the right to die will has really gotten where, what does it mean if it's that basic document?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, personally, I like to see that incorporated into the healthcare power of attorney. The new provisions on the Healthcare Power of Attorney Act, as they get passed in whatever form in each state in the country, because everybody can adopt their own, will give a lot more options and directions. And one of the things that is included in the Healthcare Power of Attorney that you don't typically see in the Right to Die will is that you can incorporate the Right to Die provisions, but you can also put some directions in there. Like, for instance, I've drafted for Catholic priests, and they want to have the benefits and burdens of their life weighed. So that might be important. Or you can just put some things like what I say as well, Sherry, if you're my attorney, in fact, I should tell you what I care about when I get there. But let's say I just couldn't bring myself to have that conversation because it was too hard. I can at least put some of that information in my healthcare power of attorney. The way you can also do it as a letter of direction,
mm-hmm.
letter of intentions, letter of desires. On specific treatments, I don't recommend those go in the healthcare power of attorney because treatments change and mm-hmm. progress. So it's more general directions about what matters to you. Another document that we have in some states is called a physician end-of-life sustaining order. Other states, they call it a MULST, a medical end-of-life sustaining order. We don't have provisions for this in every state, but this is a document that essentially is one that I suggest to a client. When you have a particular condition, review this with your physician. And if you're in a state that doesn't have legal provisions for that, you can use that discussion to create a document that gives your attorney, in fact, some directions about what you care about at end of life. In states that have... Some states also have what's called a mental health directive. Again, as this new act is passed, you may be able to incorporate those provisions into one document, because mm-hmm. now kind of that list that I just ran through is right to die will, healthcare power of attorney, physician and a life sustaining order, mental health directive. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be a little better if we could get that into one document and a little more organized? So I think that we'll see that as we go. If there are no directions or documents out there, then we have the situation where a guardianship or conservatorship may be required.
Mm-hmm. When my father was on hospice, one of the things, we had to have all of those kinds of documents handy, because if somebody called the rescue squad, we had to have a do not transport.
Right.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of things like that people don't think about. So I assume obtaining proper insurance is critical.
Proper insurance, and when we're talking about that, there's insurance that you can get to help with the cost of long-term care, which is something that's worth looking into if you're mm-hmm. aging. And then there's the insurance that should be obtained, which is critical if you're the owner or operator of a senior living community. Every state has its own requirements based on, you know, that provides how much coverage based on the type of facility. So what I really recommend in this department is to find an insurance representative with expertise in senior communities. I had the good fortune to work with somebody recently. It's one of those situations I always love. I'm like, okay, this guy knows a lot more about it than I do, and he's a total expert. This is what he does. He provides the coverage for this type of community, understands the risks that need to be covered, the types of things that happen on every level, and gets that covered. Because there's things like, should you get cybersecurity insurance? Should you have employment practices liability insurance? So if you actually do have an employee steal the ring from a resident, things like that. So there's a lot of different coverages that need to be considered.
Can senior communities evict a non-paying resident?
So a senior community can. So they're landlords just
like an apartment.
You are in the real world. With that said, there are specific rules about what must be included in the lease for a senior community. So it's not typically quite as easy as if you're living in an apartment or rental house. There has to be a valid reason for eviction, which is true really in any type of eviction. It has to be like non-payment. One of the ones that I do see is violation of community rules. So when you're putting somebody in a facility, it's really important to know what the community rules are and make a determination, will the person that I'm helping into this facility be able to comply with those? There is a process of formal notice that has to be followed. Resident has to have a clear explanation. And there's specific time frames that apply. And again, there are very state-specific laws that apply to this. And in some situations, there may be involvement of local health or social services.
So any last thoughts on this topic?
I did want to just briefly mention what we call referral service agencies for senior communities. So we have, you know, an aging population, and this has become common. And so there's some agencies out there that will help you find a location, and they don't charge you. What's important to know about the agencies that don't charge you and just ask these questions is that they are often getting paid by the facility. So they're going to provide you information on the facilities that they represent. But let's say they go to facility A, and facility A says, well, we don't want to pay you that much to give us a referral. So they're like, great, you're not on our list. Mm-hmm. And they go to facility B. Facility B has got a little shortage of residents, and maybe there's a reason why there's a shortage of residents. And the referral service agency says, well, we can fill up those vacancies for you, so they have an agreement. So it's important when exploring this to ask the question if you refute, because they do have good information. But ask them very much, which particular communities do you represent, and are there other communities? And there are some paid-for services starting to come up which are more unbiased. Those, obviously, the disadvantages, they're more expensive, but the advantages, they're keeping information on all the facilities, giving you all the options.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you for helping me out today, Sherry.
You're welcome.
As we reach the end of our episode, I want to thank our sponsors, Interactive Legal, Foster Group, Veterans Victory, and Carson Private Client. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to today's episode, and stay tuned for our weekly releases. Yeah.
The Doug and Birch Legal Visionaries podcast is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Doug and Birch Legal Visionaries podcast does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Doug and Birch Legal Visionaries podcast should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.
A Huda Media Production.